Welcome to Unsolved Murders SA, a true crime podcast based on investigations that, at the time of producing this episode, were still open. The views, information, or opinions expressed in this series are solely those of the individuals involved and do not necessarily represent those of Swisher Post, its parent company, and its partners. Some of the content featured in this series describes details of extreme violence. Therefore, viewers' discretion is strongly advised. Before we get into this episode, we'd like to thank you in advance for subscribing to our podcast. Every like, comment, and subscription goes a long way in helping us grow our Unsolved Murders SA community. If you are a new listener, then please do us a favor and subscribe to our podcast. The audio version of Unsolved Murders SA is available on Spotify, SoundCloud, and Apple Podcasts. We also upload video versions of these episodes on YouTube. Simply search Unsolved Murders SA, subscribe to our channel, and turn on notifications to stay abreast with every upload. We are a self-funded media startup, so if you enjoy our content, buying us a cup of coffee is one way to help us grow. Thank you in advance for your support. Beyond the expansive and lush mountainous landscapes that shape the beauty of the Mother City lies a lawless territory of land controlled by gangs. In the eastern periphery of Cape Town, reality is shaped by the Numbers Gang. Before we get into today's story, it is important to explore the depths of organized crime and the Numbers Gang in Cape Town. To understand what makes up a gangster, we visited the works of Don Pinnock, whose critically acclaimed book, Gangtown, dives deep into the fabric of the urban phenomenon. Pinnock describes a gang as a group of people with common interests who come together with common criminal purpose. Let's take a look at some facts Pinnock lists about gangs. Gangs are an urban phenomenon found in most cities where there's crowding and low income. They're mostly found within particular types of urban structure: tenements, low-cost neighborhoods, and squatter areas. They're generally in areas of relative, not absolute, poverty. It's mainly a male youth phenomenon. Members often have parental attachment issues. There can be links to mental and physical health issues. There's almost always a drug connection. High percentages of gang members have dropped out of school early. There are often, but not always, links to a criminal economy. They have a bad rap and use it. For many young people living in Cape Town's vast, crime-ridden areas, gang membership is a rite of passage and, in most cases, a choice between certain death and survival. While Pinnock correctly asserts that gang culture is most prevalent in relatively poor communities, the true breeding ground for gang membership is in prison. In South Africa, the prison yards are run by the Numbers Gang, a criminal organization split between three sets, the 26s, 27s, and 28s. The gang's financial strong arm, the 26s, is responsible for accumulating wealth for all numbers. Gang members affiliated with this number often express their allegiance by holding up both thumbs or depicting the hand symbol in tattoos. The 27s are the most secretive division of the Numbers Gang. While every number set has a legion of cold-blooded killers, the 27s are feared as colonels of death. If any shot caller of the number set needs a hit pulled off on an internal or external enemy, the task usually falls on a 27's hitman. The 28s are considered the bloodline of the Numbers Gang. This set is split into two subgroups, the Gold and Silver Lines. The Gold Line 28s are respected as warriors, the frontmen of all gang confrontations. The Silver Line, on the other hand, is domesticated. In the prison system's homoerotic culture, the Silver Line 28s are considered objects of desire, or sex slaves of the Gold Line, if you will. Today's episode will explore the depths of violent crimes committed by a gang from the 28s, with the aim of highlighting the gross injustices suffered by its victims at the hands of an incompetent police system. The Terrible Jousters is one of Cape Town's most deadly gangs. The name is derived from the word joust, which can be used in instances where parties compete for superiority. With more than 10,000 active members, the Terrible Jousters, or the TJs in short, have established a firm foothold in the drug trade in Delft South, a community situated on the eastern outskirts of Cape Town. Horatio Solomon and Alton Lenteng, also known as Koffie, led the gang on its reign of terror between March 2002 and January 2017. This culminated into one of the most eventful trials that ended with more than 20 high-ranking members and bosses found guilty of more than 145 charges and sentenced to life behind bars. Although mention will be made of other crimes, for the most part, we will focus a great amount of attention on 5 of the 12 murders the gang committed between August 2009 and December 2016. So let's get into it. The downfall of the terrible rosters can be traced to one man, only referred to in court documents as CF, the brother of Ismail and Ismail Okertz, and a close associate of Koffie. If CF had not entered the frame, it's highly likely that the terrible rosters would have claimed more lives on their destructive path to dominance in the Cape Town turf wars. CF started the undoing of the terrible rosters in the latter part of 2015, while he was awaiting trial in Goodwood for charges related to the theft of a motor vehicle. A gangster his whole life, CF's decision to leave the number system was made after he received instructions from the 28th hierarchy to stab an inmate in the prison he was held at. Well aware of the consequences he'd face for disobeying a direct order to kill, CF reported the matter to the head of the prison, Mr. H. Hanukum. Hanukum arranged for CF to be transferred to the hospital section as a diversion to lower suspicion from his gangmates. CF testified that he had, in any event, been wanting to withdraw from the gang for some time. He told Hanukum that he had information about the criminal activities of the terrible rosters. During his first interview with a lieutenant colonel named Orcase, CF made it clear he wanted witness protection, and so a procedure was set in motion, where the informant was released on bail on November 6, 2015, and entered into the Section 204 program. CF was interviewed for several days in January 2016, and to the shock of investigators, every murder case he mentioned had a corresponding case docket that had gone cold due to inactivity or lack of leads. One of the investigators who interviewed CF, Captain Joubert, recalled in court documents how forthcoming the informant was with the information. Joubert did not initiate discussion on particular incidents. It was CF who identified the incidents of which he had knowledge. In the end, CF submitted 26 statements between November 10, 2015 and December 4, 2018, all implicating high-ranking members of the terrible rosters, including himself, and tying each accused to already existing cases. Although 12 terrible rosters were eventually found guilty and sentenced for charges related to the contraventions of the Prevention of Organized Crime Act, conspiracy to commit murder in contravention of the Riotous Assemblies Act, illegal firearms, and other violent crimes, this episode will focus on unraveling a chronological account of the murders listed in this particular trial. Jermaine Lowe, or Joey, was a 28th contract killer working under the instruction of Koffie and an active member of the terrible rosters. Joey was viciously gunned down in Bell Hall on the evening of Sunday, August 30th, 2009. Results from his autopsy confirmed he died at 9:33 p.m. from a single gunshot wound that perforated his left lung. Testifying in court, CF revealed that Joey's fate was sealed that Sunday afternoon when he received a text message from Koffie, who ordered him to return an urgent phone call. When he obliged, CF was informed by Koffie that Horatio Solomon, the other terrible roster boss, wanted Joey dead. Apparently, Joey had smoked crystal meth, colloquially referred to as tick, with his daughter Deirdre at his house. That single phone call was enough to wind down the clock for Joey. CF was picked up by Koffie and the pair travelled to a property in Belleville, where a man named Jermaine McKenzie, aka Piggles, resided. Here's the first of many plot twists. CF and Piggles were childhood friends, who grew apart and became enemies later in adulthood. CF rose up the ranks as a terrible jester, while Piggles devoted his allegiance to another notorious gang operating as the Junior Mafia. The Junior Mafia and the Terrible Jostas were technically enemies, but according to court documents, Piggles was also a hitman for hire, and apart from the fact that there was an active peace treaty between both gangs at the time, the two childhood mates shared a bizarre camaraderie over their ranks as contract killers. Anyway, according to CF, he and Coffey approached Piggles with a straightforward assignment. Kill Joey at exactly 8 p.m. that evening. The significance of the time cannot be understated. CF explained during the trial that leaders of the Terrible Jostas were firm believers in witchcraft, and before the meeting to plot Joey's murder, Coffey had consulted a witch doctor who had indicated that 8 p.m. was a favorable time to commit the murder. The assumption here is that the witch doctor, whose consultation holds a great deal of esteem and, more importantly, authority in African culture, had implied that if Joey's murder was executed outside of this timestamp, the culminating events would not be favorable to the gang. Consequently, whether by design or a dark form of divinity, Joey was killed at 9:33 p.m. that night. To mask their involvement in the murder plot, CF and Coffey attended Joey's funeral the following week. Solomon, who ordered the hit, was a no-show, but he did, according to CF, instruct Coffey to gift Joey's mother 10,000 rand, around $525, for her troubles. 2 months after the murder, on November 1st, 2009, Piggles was arrested and charged with killing Joey. Piggles was prosecuted for the murder, but as you will learn from the content of this episode, getting away with killing someone is very likely in South Africa. On September 20th, 2010, Piggles was acquitted of Joey's murder. The state just did not have enough to secure a conviction. In fact, there were technical errors committed by the police that Piggles' attorneys used to secure the acquittal. The murder of Piggles went cold for 7 years, before CF decided to turn state in a bid to escape the numbers gang. There are some discrepancies around murders that may have occurred between Joey's death and September 13, 2012, the day Levitt Siukwe, known as Sharky, was killed. In his testimony, CF, the informant, vaguely recalled the murder of a man named Denzel Bota and the attempted hit on the life of an enemy of the TJs, only referred to as Buya, as possible violent crimes he may have participated in that 3-year gap. One event that had most certainly taken place within that time period occurred a month before Sharky's death, on August 13th, 2012. That evening, a house on 11 Andreth Avenue, Belhar, was targeted in a shooting where a woman, Enna Kleinhans, who has since passed away in an unrelated incident, was struck in the foot. According to CF, the property was earmarked for an ambush orchestrated by Coffey and another senior-ranking TJ member, Michael Solomon, aka China. The shooting was an apparent attempt to ambush a group of junior mafias, but despite firing more than 11 rounds, they had failed to strike a single member of the rival gang. That case also ended with all accused parties either acquitted or charges related to the incident withdrawn due to a lack of sufficient evidence. Back to Sharky. A month had passed since the failed attempt at pulling off a mass murder on Anreth Avenue, and not too far away from that crime scene, in an alley, the lifeless body of Sharky was discovered at around 6 p.m. on September 13, 2012. According to the post-mortem report, Sharky sustained 7 gunshot wounds, 3 in his chest, 3 in his head and neck area, and another in the back of his left hand. At the crime scene, police found 7 spent 9mm Parabellum shell casings and 1 other unfired bullet from the same type of firearm. Police later discovered that a second victim, Nashif Khrodbum, was also hit, but he was rushed to hospital. Khrodbum was shot 3 times, once in the buttocks, and twice on his thigh. He survived the ordeal, but court documents show that he had initially refused to cooperate in the investigation. Subsequent investigations led police to Michael Solomon and a high-ranking TJ called Tyrone Constable. However, in this case too, due to a lack of sufficient evidence to secure a conviction, the state was forced to withdraw charges against Michael and Tyrone on January 20th, 2014. CF would implicate himself and others in the murder of Sharkey and the attempt on Grootboom's life in his Section 204 statement 2 years later. According to CF, the plot to murder Sharkey and Grootboom, two members of the junior mafia, was made at Michael Solomon's house following the death of a senior ranking leader of the TJs, Hilton Adrianza, aka Ginger. Ismail Okert was nominated by Kofi to execute the revenge murder, and CF was assigned as his accomplice. The two contract killers traveled to Anrith Avenue in Solomon's white Volkswagen Golf, where they were tipped off by China that junior mafia gang members were selling drugs in an alley nearby. The car the killers were traveling in had a Monster Energy drink sticker on the back windscreen. The sticker was later used to connect the gang to other crimes. CF testified that he and Okert loaded with a 357 revolver and a 9mm pistol, posed as addicts looking for drugs, and came across Sharkey, who was in the middle of a sale near a green electricity box he used to hide his stash. CF and Okertz handed Sharkey cash for the purchase, and as he kneeled down to retrieve the drugs, Okertz approached him from behind, pressed his firearm into Sharkey's neck, and pulled him up. When he tried to release fire, the pistol jammed, and Sharkey, aware of the contract killer's ploy, began to struggle for the weapon. His attempts were in vain, however, since by then CF had cocked his revolver and fired a single shot into Sharkey's chest. As he fell backwards, Okert lifted him up in a chokehold with his left arm and fired shots into Sharkey's neck and shoulders, killing him instantly. Nashif Grootboom heard the scuffle and came out of a nearby property to see what was happening. That's when he was shot 3 times by CF. He would have died too had CF's revolver not been empty by the time he'd approached him to deliver a deathly headshot. After the shooting, CF and Okert returned to Michael Solomon's house and got rid of the firearms. Grootboom survived the ordeal, but again, his refusal to cooperate played a significant role in the case being dismissed. About a week after Sharkey was killed, his fellow gangmate, Brandon Dixon, aka Mablo, was the terrible justice's next target. Mablo was identified as the junior mafia gang member responsible for the death of Ginger. On the first attempt on his life, TJ's gang member, only referred to as Tyrone in court documents, along with his cousin Fabian Constable, ambushed Mablo on his way back from an airport shopping mall with his girlfriend and childhood mate Nolan van Schalkwyk on the afternoon of September 18, 2012. Evidence showed in court that Tyrone and Fabian had fired multiple shots at Mablo, but failed to pull off the murder, and instead struck multiple innocent bystanders, including a young boy who sustained a gunshot wound to his leg. The next day, another junior mafia gang member, Topi Sali, was targeted in a murder attempt which, once again, was botched, this time by CF and another gang member only referred to as Mone. Ballistics collected at the Sali crime scene matched fragments found at the scene of Mablo's attempted murder, as well as shell casings discovered at the scene of Sharkey's murder a week earlier. The terrible justice tyrannous rampage had reached fever pitch at this point. It was all in the name of exacting revenge on the junior mafia for the murder of Ginger. But a great deal of dissatisfaction was felt since Mablo and Sali were still alive. While Sali had managed to avoid another encounter with the terrible justice, Mablo's fate was sealed 4 months later. By then, a series of court appearances proved, yet again, to expose the sheer weakness of South Africa's judicial system. CF, Tyrone, and Fabian were arrested and charged with the murder of Sharkey and the attempted murders of Mablo and Sali. Prosecutors had ballistic evidence tying the suspects to all three crimes. However, forensic evidence was not enough to keep the tyrannous trio behind bars. In fact, prior history of extreme violence committed by the terrible justice had no bearing in preventing them from being released on bail. Perhaps Mablo's fate was always sealed, but one can reasonably suggest that he may have lived a bit longer if the law actually worked against organized criminals. For example, CF and Fabian were granted bail and released from prison in November 2012, 2 months after killing Sharkey and attempting to murder Mablo and Sali. CF's attempted murder charge in the Sali case was withdrawn for lack of evidence, but the TJ whistleblower was back behind bars on January 8, 2012 for pointing a loaded firearm at a man named Roger Grove. 2 days later, CF was back on the streets, and that charge was withdrawn in February 2013, back to Mablo's death. According to CF's testimony, he had paid Tyrone and Fabian a visit after delivering drugs to a man only referred to as daughter in court documents. Further checks on CF's claims showed that, in fact, Tyrone was still in prison on Monday, January 21st, 2013, the day Mablo was killed. Alas, CF testified that he and Fabian were on their way to a house in Bahal when they spotted Mablo on the back of a pickup truck parked at the KFC drive-thru situated on the intersection of Arterial Road and Bahal Drive, close to TJ boss Horatio Solomon's house. CF and Fabian made a quick U-turn to Horatio's house to get explicit permission from the leader to execute the hit on Mablo. According to the whistleblower, Horatio approved the hit and handed them a 9mm pistol from a house across the road. The hit was Fabian's to pull off. So CF and the crew stood outside Horatio's house while Fabian walked across to an open field toward the KFC drive-thru. CF shortly followed in a car and parked at a Caltex petrol station not too far away from the KFC. A few moments after he'd gotten out of the car, a gunshot went off and CF immediately knew this was his cue to collect Fabian. Sure enough, CF drove to the intersection on Arterial Road and picked up Fabian, who was casually walking along the road after publicly shooting Mablo in cold blood. No words were exchanged when the duo drove back to Horatio's place. Back at the KFC, police arrived at the crime scene shortly after 7:15 p.m. Constable Vasahi was still on the scene collecting photographic evidence at 7:41 p.m. when Mablo was certified dead. His body was on the ground at the back of the pickup. He was lying on his stomach, still wearing a black beanie which was pulled down about halfway over his ears. The post-mortem report revealed a single entry wound on Mablo's right temple above the left eye towards the center of his forehead. A deformed bullet and casing were retrieved inside the skull. Before we get into the details of the fifth and final murder, let's consider the weight of loyalty in gang culture. Loyalty, by definition, is to give constant and firm support, or more importantly, for the context of this episode, allegiance to a person or institute. In gang culture, loyalty is earned in several ways. In the number system, you earn the gang's loyalty by initiation, which, more often than not, involves the death of a target. Fabian was specifically tasked with killing Mablo because he had to prove himself to the terrible trusters. The tyranny of the TJs in 2013 was, for the most part, spurred by avenging the death of Ginger. The gang felt it necessary to get even with the junior mafia out of loyalty to Ginger. More interesting, remember Jermaine McKenzie, aka Piggles, CF's childhood friend who was hired to kill Joey Lowe, the terrible joster that was caught smoking crystal meth with Horatio's daughter Deirdre? Well, it can be argued that Piggles, who was a sworn enemy of CF, leaned on his loyalty to their childhood and the peace treaty between the terrible justers and the junior mafia when he agreed to kill Joey. But as you are about to find out, loyalty in gang culture is fleeting. Our story begins on the fateful day of March 3rd, 2013, when the life of Jermaine McKenzie, known by his street name Piggles, was brutally taken away. According to CF, tensions were high between the TJs and the junior mafia, the gang Piggles belonged to. The TJs wanted Piggles dead, and CF was about to become a key witness to these events. On that morning, CF was waiting outside his family home when he encountered Piggles, who provocatively gestured towards him. Worried for his safety, CF contacted Alton Illy, a prominent member of the TJs, to inform him about the incident. Illy made arrangements for CF to pick up Keegan Kruger, who claimed to know someone willing to carry out a hit on Piggles. CF drove to Old Bell Hall to collect Keegan Kruger, who was later revealed to be number 11, from his grandmother's house. Along the way, Illy instructed CF to pick up another individual named Dachabas, who would join Keegan Kruger as the shooters. Finally, the group arrived at the location only referred to in court documents as WG Park, where Keegan Kruger obtained two firearms from an undisclosed location behind a substation. CF dropped off Keegan Kruger and Ahabas in Bahar, providing them with the firearms and instructed them on the route they should take. Meanwhile, CF positioned himself on the corner of the street and observed Pickles in his front yard, unaware of the imminent danger. Keegan Kruger and Ahabas approached from the far side of the street, kicking a stray football to initiate contact with Pickles. At close range, Ahabas fired the first shot, followed by Keegan Kruger. CF's recollections from the precise details of the shooting were inconsistent. Initially, he claimed that Keegan Kruger emptied his gun on Pickles, but later, during cross-examination, he mentioned leaving the scene after hearing Dahaba's shot and did not witness the subsequent shots. After the shooting, CF picked up Keegan Kruger and Dahaba's. The reliability of CF's statement came into question during cross-examination, as he provided varying accounts of what he observed. The defense highlighted the discrepancies in his statements, leaving doubts about the accuracy of his recollections. Pickles was admitted to Tigerberg Hospital on that same day, March 3, 2013, with multiple gunshot wounds. He was still alive and fully conscious. He suffered a total of 8 bullet injuries. The next day, CF heard rumors that Pickles was still alive and was hospitalized at Tigerberg Hospital. Illy instructed CF to visit the hospital and pull out the tubes if Pickles was still alive. Pickles gave a police statement on March 7th, 4 days after being shot. He confirmed that he was shot in the street by Dahabas and told the story the state presented. He admitted his gang affiliation as a 28 and a member of the Junior Mafia. He died on June 12, 2013 from gunshot wounds and recurring chest infections. The prosecution challenged CF's credibility regarding his statement about witnessing Pickles' family switching off the life support machines. CF explained that he based his assumption on the emotional scene he witnessed at the hospital, but acknowledged that his version might not accurately reflect the events. Throughout the trial, inconsistencies emerged in CF's statement regarding the involvement of certain individuals, particularly in relation to Keegan Kruger and another gang member named Number 7, who was known as Kapadin. These inconsistencies raised doubts about CF's reliability as a witness. The ballistics report indicated that there was at least one shooter armed with a pistol who fired multiple shots, while the medical evidence showed that Pickles was struck by multiple bullets. According to CF, Keegan Kruger was the shooter with the pistol, while Dahabas fired a single shot with a revolver. However, Pickles' statement contradicted CF's version, stating that only one shooter was involved. The defense also questioned CF's account of events after the shooting, as his initial police statement did not mention picking up Keegan Kruger and Dahabas. CF claimed that he had forgotten to inform the investigator about this detail, only remembering to mention it later during subsequent consultations. The reliability of CF's testimony and his motives came under scrutiny during the trial. While his recollections and versions were inconsistent, it is crucial to examine the evidence as a whole to ascertain the truth. Between the death of Pickles, who was murdered on March 3, 2013, and the end of 2014, the terrible justice were responsible for at least 8 other brutal killings linked to gang violence. The victims and the dates of the murders were Leon Davids, killed in October 2013, Vernon Boats, killed in June 2014, Niano Kleinhans, killed in July 2014, Aubrey Johannes, killed in July 2014, Wayne Lekeer, killed in July 2014, Larry Kay, killed in October 2014, George Stevens, killed in February 2016, Victor Browers, killed in December 2016. And that brings us to the conclusion of our Unsolved Murders Essay episode on the harrowing crimes involving the terrible justice. As the trial unfolded, numerous counts were examined and the fate of the accused gang members was determined. Let's take a closer look at the verdicts. In the charges related to the Prevention of Organized Crime Act, also known as POCA, Horatio Solomon and Ismail Okertz were acquitted, while number 1 and number 2 were found guilty on the primary count due to their convictions on other charges. As for the other gang members, Brian, Ismail Okertz, Alton Ely, Brent Campbell, Bradley Roberts, Lizay Boyson, Fabian Constable, Ziad Safuddin, Keenan Kruger, and Lucian Consul. They were acquitted on various counts under the poker charges. Moving on to the counts directly linked to the murder of Jermaine McKenzie. Alton Ely and Keenan Kruger, identified as number 5 and number 11 respectively, were acquitted on all counts. Questions were raised about their involvement in Piggle's demise. As the trial progressed, other counts related to attempted murders and additional homicides were examined. The verdicts varied across the board, with some individuals being acquitted on certain counts while others faced convictions. Notably, Bradley Roberts, also known as Number 7, was acquitted on all charges related to the murder of Brandon Dixon. Throughout the trial, the reliability of the confidential informant referred to as CF was questioned. CF's inconsistent recollections and discrepancies in his statements caused doubt on the accuracy of his testimonies. This brings us to the end of our episode. If you enjoyed our podcast, please consider giving us a star rating. We appreciate all the feedback and it helps us improve the quality of our podcast. Also, if you have a story you would like us to investigate, please send us an email at info@swishapost.co.za and provide us with as much information as possible. Please note that the story suggestions must be based in South Africa.